You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Most New York Times readers who like to cook keep a cherished collection of classic recipes clipped from the paper's food columns in their kitchens. New York Times food writer Amanda Hesser has compiled and time-tested over 1,000 of those reader favorites and revived them in the Essential New York Times Cookbook, Classic Recipes for a New Century. It's published by W.W. Norton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Amanda Hesser back to our show. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Now, many of the Times food writers have written cookbooks over the years, but there hasn't been a New York Times cookbook since Craig Claiborne released his in the 1960s. Considering the incredible number of recipes that Times has published over the 51 years since, why do you think there hasn't been a new one?
Well, there have been different sort of iterations of New York Times cookbooks. I mean, Craig himself did a few. You know, he did an international cookbook. Florence Fabricant did a dessert cookbook. But no one sort of did an all-encompassing book. And it wasn't so much, I mean, for me that, I mean, yes, the New York Times publishes tons of recipes every week. And so you can imagine how much they add up over the years. But it was more that so much had happened in food since 1961, since he wrote his, his famous book. And it just seemed like it was time to take a look back.
So how did you put this collection together?
Well, it was one of those projects where I sort of leapt at the opportunity because it seemed like it would be so much fun. And then as soon as the reality started sinking in of like how massive this project was. So what I did was put a notice in the an author's query, essentially, in the newspaper and the magazine asking readers what their favorite recipes were. Because I figured, I had only been working at the New York Times since 1997, and I didn't grow up reading the New York Times. So I didn't have this kind of history of the archives in my head. You know, I didn't have really much to start with. So
in fact, your culinary history to some degree is in France, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes. Yeah. And so I asked them and it was amazing.
How many responses did you get?
Thousands. And I mean the next day my email inbox was just flooded. And for 4 years they sent in, they didn't just email me, they sent me their original tattered clippings with handwritten notes on them. And they sent me, you know, note cards explaining what these recipes meant to them. And it really became the sort of their recipe suggestions became the backbone of this book.
And I'd assume that some recipes showed up again and again and again.
Yeah. And that was really kind of incredible because most of the recipe suggestions tended to be recipes that were printed from the 1960 forward because before that, people are no longer cooking or even living. So what really surprised me was the number of recipes that were 20 years old that dozens of people wrote in about. For instance, I mean, the most famous recipe of all time from the New York Times is Marion Burroughs's plum tort, originally published in 1983. So almost 30 years old now. And 265 people wrote in about that recipe.
And if you're curious about it, by the way, we've included it on our website with a number of other recipes from this book. I think we put 4 up there, but we had to include that one.
Yeah.
Well, since the book came out, have you received any feedback from readers disappointed that their favorite recipe, the one they sent to you as the most important one, hasn't been included?
Oh, yeah, of course. And but that, of course, was my biggest fear. And that was that I was going to be I was going to have missed something really important. And for the most part, it doesn't seem like I've missed any like huge things. But yes, I've gotten a few letters that are like, how could you have not included my favorite, you know, babka or whatever.
Are any of these from the original Claiborne version?
Oh, yeah, many.
But I'd imagine they're changed because, first of all, the things I have in my kitchen that I cook with have changed. Ingredients are different these days. And also, haven't food tastes in America changed?
Oh, absolutely. But I wasn't aiming to create a book that felt necessarily modern. I wanted to create a book that was relevant, meaning that any recipe in that book is one that you would want to know and you'd want to have with you for the rest of your life. That was really kind of the way I made a decision whether or not a recipe should go in the book. But So not only are there Craig Claiborne recipes from the 60s and 70s and 80s and pretty much intact, but there are recipes going back to the 19th century. And, you know, the thing is that, if a recipe didn't hold up, if it didn't have still have something interesting to say, if it still wasn't great, it didn't go in the book. So, yeah, I'm sure there are many Claiborne recipes that maybe are too outdated or just not interesting enough, but so many of them were great. And in fact, and I would say definitely Pierre Freinet, his recipes hold up beautifully. He's just a really great recipe writer.
Now, you say that you went back to the 19th century, but there are big gaps in the 20th century.
Yes, there are.
So is the late 19th century more interesting than what happened between, what would we say, 1920 and 1960?
Yes. That was a sort of a dark period.
Mostly Jell-O molds, although you know you
no,
can...
Well, not in the New York Times, but actually it was just more of a dearth of material in the New York Times during that period. You know, the wars did tremendous damage to our food culture, mostly because it sort of evaporated. And then when it returned, there was this huge push for convenience food and women, you know, wanting to be sort of liberated from the kitchen. And so we're still kind of recovering from that. And you did see bits of that in the Times, and what happened was that in the late 1950s, the New York Times hired Craig Claiborne, and previously, in the 1940s and 1950s, it was sort of the writing was much more about, like, they were sort of by home economists who were helping you get dinner on the table, but not in a very inspired or joyful way. And Craig, you know, marched in, and here is somebody who A, grew up in the South, so good food is in his blood; B, spent a lot of time in Europe cooking. He really knew what good food was, and he also just was very curious. So he would write about Indonesian food. He wrote about Middle Eastern food. You know, he made French food stylish, and he just made food exciting. And that really energized the New York Times food coverage, and it's still energized from that period.
My guess is Amanda Hesser, who's latest book is The Essential New York Times Cookbook, Classic Recipes for a New Century, published by Norton. Well, going back to the 19th century, I was surprised that the Times even printed recipes, although I'm assuming that they're very different than what we think of a recipe today. In those days, they used to say, throw in salt and cook until it's done.
Exactly. You know, when I started the project, I didn't realize this either. And the recipe archive from the 19th century is huge. And it's a treasure trove because they're actually – there was tons of food coverage, and it wasn't just recipes, but it was like household tips. And I mean, there were stories about how olive oil was produced. There were, you know, sort of cooking lessons. There was just a huge amount of food coverage. And I think it was because people really like had to cook, and you know, the New York City markets at that time were incredibly bountiful. And so the variety of foods you also saw on the pages were incredible. And the thing that was totally great, from a research perspective, was that most of the recipes came from readers. So it was what people were really cooking.
Although in those days, nobody said the word locavore, but everything was locavore, right?
Exactly.
You say Anthony Bourdain would have been happy during those early New York Times food reporting years.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, there was terrapin, and there was brain fritters, and there were lots of things, tripe, plenty of tripe.
Well, how many of those things did you wind up picking up? Because brain fritters probably would not be cooked by many of your readers.
Yeah. And I did try to stay mindful of that, but I did include a tripe recipe. I passed up terrapin, which was quite a popular ingredient. It was kind of a luxury good. And
I'm not sure what terrapin is.
Oh, turtle.
Ah.
It was something that you would get at a fine restaurant. So there were lots of recipes for turtle soup. And I just felt like that was a little bit out of reach and could be left behind. And people are welcome to dig through the archives and find the recipes. But the recipes, as you said, are incredibly brief. And they assume that you know a lot. So if it's a pie recipe, they never tell you how to make the pastry. They just say, they call it paste. So they would say, you know, make a stiff paste. And line your pan, never telling you what size pan or what temperature the oven should be.
It. Or,
yeah, nothing. They just assumed you knew all the basics. So I filled that in.
The book includes both high and low brow cooking, from the Grand Central Oyster Pan Roast to the Bacon Explosion. I'm assuming that's one of the reasons it's so huge. But since it has over 1,000 recipes, and in some cases like the ones from the 19th century, you're pretty much reinventing them. Did you have to go and test every one of these?
Oh, yeah.
Not in your home kitchen.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it took 6 years to do this book, and I didn't do it alone. My friend Meryl Stubbs and I tested all the recipes together, and we tested 1,400 recipes.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Did you have any idea what you were getting yourself
no.
into?
And about halfway through, I just thought, oh, God, what have I done? You know, I compare it to like a home renovation where you think it's a great idea when you start, and then you become very depressed midway.
Well, it sounds kind of like what happened to the woman who wrote Julie and Julia.
Yeah.
Or is it Julia and Julie? I can't remember. Anyway, but halfway through, she realized she was really making it very difficult on herself. You have included multiple versions of the same recipe in some cases. You have two eggnog recipes and six different gazpachos because no one is the best?
I did that for a couple of reasons. The first reason was that in receiving all of these reader suggested recipes, you could see patterns. So we collated all those recipes so you could into kind of like cookbook categories, and you could see, for instance, that gazpacho was a really popular. Lots of different kinds of gazpachos were popular among New York Times readers. Cheesecake is really popular. Meatloaf, lemon desserts, apple cakes, and so I knew like I wanted to include a couple of examples of each because people were. I mean, there were many recipes that got many recommendations. So. And I also wanted to show the arc so that you could see where gazpacho started with Craig Claiborne in the 1960s and how it evolved to a much more kind of sophisticated thing in the 2000s.
And not just the changing in the recipes. This cookbook is almost a sociological study because food writing has changed so much over the years.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the food movements and fads have changed so much over the years.
Yeah, and you know the thing is that so the Times Food and Recipe Archive is this sort of incredible document because it's like the longest continuous sort of tracking of how we eat and how we think about food. And what's really interesting is that you know it used to be very much focused on recipes, and now it's expanded into food politics and to chemistry and you know sort of looking at food from all angles and celebrating it. And I think that you know. Food coverage has only gotten better and better.
So do you think the Times has sometimes set the pace of food culture, or are its food columns more a reflection of what's happening at any given time?
Well, the funny thing is that, you know, having been a reporter at the Times, you kind of have a sense that, you know, the Times broadcasts what it sort of thinks, you know, is matters and is interesting at the moment, and that people consume that information and run with it. But in fact, what I learned is by asking readers what their favorite recipes were, was that we aren't the arbiters. They are. They are the ones who sort of, you know, take in what, you know, they read the New York Times, they read other publications. But what they ultimately cook and how they choose to shop, it's really in their hands. And it's really this kind of social mechanism because they're talking to their friends and they're comparing ideas and information, and that ultimately it's really them to sort of decide what direction we're heading.
You say that in the process of writing this book, you encountered some interesting food issues in the New York Times Style Guide.
Oh.
Can you give us an example about writing and I guess what words are
acceptable? Oh, yes, of course. Well, they're just like little expressions, you know, that I did have to change because, you know, Craig Claiborne would say, you know, in a kettle – mm-hmm. You know, add butter. And nobody knows what a kettle is. I mean, and I assumed he meant a Dutch oven. And even a Dutch oven is sort of
it could be a stock pot.
Yeah, a stock up. Exactly. Things like bring to the boil. And there are just lots of little expressions like that that, you know, really make no sense to anyone anymore.
There are also all sorts of ingredients that are now common that we never could get earlier, or we can only get in frozen versions. And then there are things like ethnic foods, like although I'm not sure whether it's lychee nut or lychee nut, but one day it was everywhere.
Yeah.
Other than in Chinatown.
Well, I would say the thing that I was quite surprised by was that there were some things that were much more available in the 19th century than now. For instance, salsify is something you see on restaurant menus now, but you really don't see in the market. But it was something that a home cook, you know, wrote in a recipe for. So in some ways, there was more variety in the past, but and now it's more kind of a like a a hunger for the esoteric, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're cooking it every day.
My guest is Amanda Hesser. Her latest book is The Essential New York Times Cookbook, Classic Recipes for a New Century, published by W.W. Norton. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Amanda Hesser, who has devoted 6 years of her life. She's done other stuff along the way, but 6 years to putting together The Essential New York Times Cookbook, 1,000 recipes or so?
About or so. I actually don't know the precise number.
Well, who's counting when you're having so much fun? But we mentioned earlier that there are these big gaps. You call the first 40 years of the 20th century a culinary abyss. And there isn't much here between in the 40s and 50s as well, because you say during that period there wasn't an ingredient on earth that couldn't be suspended in Jell-O.
There's that. And there just wasn't, let's say, inspired food coverage.
Well, I don't mean to pick on the Midwest, but I've had meals in Ohio recently that still featured Jell-O mold course. So some of these things are still popular. And I would think that the food that you call the dark ages of American cuisine is still popular in some parts of the country.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in some ways, it's kind of nice because you can sort of walk through history as you travel. And I mean, in the same way, you go to some, you know, smaller cities and you eat in a restaurant and it feels kind of 1980s. And even in New York City, there are plenty of restaurants that you go to that are of another era. And it's kind
of those Italian restaurants that had veal parmesan. And
yeah. And there's something nice about that. Like restaurants in some ways are kind of mini museums, and they can preserve whatever era they want.
Yeah, but the world was different. Craig Claiborne, you say, actually would have people call him, look him up in the phone book and call him with questions about – I mean,
yes,
is your phone number listed?
No, people did call me at the New York Times. Yeah, people would call him while they were cooking, and he would help them out. He would coach them through it. I think that this is maybe like a time-honored tradition with Times writers, because I certainly had the same thing happen to me, which always made me laugh, because I thought, if you are having a problem, like your veal chop doesn't look quite right, you know, you usually think, okay, I'm going to call my mother or my friend. But I wouldn't think like to call the New York Times, but some people do.
It's interesting. We're already getting responses from our listeners of, well, of course, one person points out, James Brom from Inwood, that you can get salsify in New York City markets, including Union Square Farmers Market.
Oh, sure. Yes, Union Square, which is like the most, like the leading farmers market, you know, on the East Coast. I mean, I think, yes, of course, you can get it in Union Square, but you're not going to find it on, you know, in perhaps the farmers market in Williamsburg or in Philadelphia. You know, it's not that common.
And then, sure, we got a complaint. A caller says her wants to know why her favorite New York Times recipe, which is Kitchen Stewart salad, was not in the book. It's a mix of avocado, onion, lime juice, and jalapeno.
I know that because I edited that story. And I didn't include that for one specific reason, which is that when that recipe was published, and I love that recipe very much, we got a lot of feedback because jalapenos vary in heat. And you eat like raw, like there's a lot of raw jalapeno in it. And if you get a hot one, it's inedible. And I just worried that that too many people would have a bad experience. So I'm glad that point was raised.
And we asked people on Facebook what their favorite New York Times cookbook recipes were. And Jess told us his were arroz con pollo and coq au vin. Obviously, the guy likes chicken.
Well,
and those are both from Craig Claiborne.
That's so great because, you know, once we collated all of these recipes and you looked at them, we joked that – Meryl and I joked that the book should be called Chicken and Dessert.
Well, we had to choose as well, and we chose four recipes from the book to put on our website. And they are cucumbers in cream, French flourless chocolate cake, the purple plum tort that we were talking about, and also David Ayer's pancake.
They're some of my favorites. I'm so glad you chose them. The cucumbers and cream is the kind of recipe you look at and you don't think it's going to be anything special, and it's the best cucumber salad I've ever had. It has lemon zest and juice and sour cream, but it's done just so.
When you were looking over the archives, did you find yourself liking the recipes of certain writers more than others? I mean, one of the most intriguing characters in the book is a chef named Bob the Sea Cook.
Everyone loves Bob. I love Bob.
Who was he?
So Bob, you know, I haven't been able to figure out whether he was like he was a character created by the writer, or if he actually was Bob the Sea Cook. He seems to have been very well traveled, because he wrote, you know, great curry recipes and great, you know, polenta with sausages, you know, very much the kind of Italian country cooking in the 19th century. And he had a great writing voice. Every recipe was kind of a story, and he would often say things. I mean, he was also, while he was very funny and entertaining, he also was quite sexist and would say things like, you know, now peel the garlic. If there's a woman on board, have her do it.
Ooh.
but he was still somehow charming. And so a number of his recipes made it into the book. But, you know, having been a reporter at the Times, I was so busy doing my own stories that I actually, before I started this project, had not really cooked a lot of recipes of other people, except for maybe Molly O'Neill. And it was so great, because there's Mark Bittman, you know, a few desks away, and I barely kind of knew him as a cook until I dug in. And, you know, what a great cooking mind he has. And same with Pierre Frainie. You know, here's somebody whose recipes seem perhaps dated, but once you start cooking them, they're incredible. So,
he's
yeah.
He's also one of the most charming people I've ever met in my life. He was on the show a number of times and told some hilarious stories, which I'm not going to repeat now only because they take too much time, but they were really funny. So has it changed, influenced the way that you cook at home now?
Well, I feel like this is...
ingredients that you hadn't tried before?
Certainly there were like techniques, you know, and I think of some, actually a Mark Bittman technique for shrimp. It's a simple shrimp and green sauce, this kind of thing that we've had at a restaurant. You know, everyone's had at a restaurant. But he does something where he heats the oven to 500 degrees. And, you know, and he makes the green sauce and tosses the shrimp in it right before putting on the hot pan. And they cook really quickly without getting that sort of dried bit on the edge. And they maintain this, like, nice snap, and the sauce stays vibrant. And it's just something very simple, but it really transforms the recipe. And now I feel like, oh, I would never cook it any other way.
Some of these recipes are labor-intensive with a lot of steps, like bourguignon. But the move recently has, and I'm thinking Mark Bittman, has been towards simplicity, hasn't it?
Well, yes and no. I would like to point out, yes, there are some recipes in the book that are kind of like the weekend challenges. You know, there's like gumbo, and there is turducken, which I included intentionally because I want...
anybody make turducken?
Oh, yeah. And cassoulet. And there, I feel like I have a bunch of friends who, that's all they kind of cook. They cook projects. These triumphant, like, you know, Everests of recipes. But for the most part, the book is very much like weeknight home cooking recipes. And so, in that way, we've aimed toward much more pared down. Like, I often laugh at the Pierre Frainie 60-minute gourmet, because nobody would think that is time-saving. But in the 1970s, that was the time-saving approach. And, but the thing about recipes today is that while they're pared down, they actually have much more complexity. We tend to want lots of, you know, we want a variety of textures. We want a variety of flavors. The biggest shift, I would say, in the past 50 years is actually towards heat and spice. Like, we layer in spice and heat in many, and the use, and also I would say, like, the very specific use of salt, you know, much more than we did in the past.
Well, when you include prompts like, when it comes to pastry and bread doughs, remember you're the boss. So is half the battle psychological?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I think a lot of cooking is about finding your confidence, really, and your conviction, and feeling like, you know what you're doing, even if you're doing something that you've never done before.
And you also encourage people to do things that are very easy to get in stores, like make their own ice cream.
Yes, yeah. Because
is it that much better?
I think it is. Yes. I mean, commercial ice creams are a completely different animal, and they are mostly oversweetened, way oversweetened, and not enough salt. And so homemade ice cream, I think, is a wonderful thing.
I don't see gums and stuff in mine.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And you can get really pure flavors. And there are actually some great desserts, frozen sort of quote unquote ice creams, if you don't have a machine. Like Craig Claiborne, he did a bunch of recipes that they were called velvets. And they were essentially where you would kind of make this meringue and you would fold in whipped cream and then you would freeze that. So you would get that really smooth kind of airy ice cream texture without having to have a machine.
But there are machines that range from fairly inexpensive.
Yeah, I mean, there's that great Cuisinart one that was like less than $50 that everyone seems to have. And it works really well.
You attach it, or a KitchenAid has one too. You attach it to the mixer, and it just does well after you've stuck the bowl in the freezer for a while.
Yeah.
And hope that it got really cold. You've been with the New York Times for over a decade as both a writer and an editor, but you say one of your most cherished titles came from Gawker. He called you an evil foodie dark lord. Where did that come from?
You know, I can't even remember, but I always loved that because I just thought, you know, sure, I'll be a dark lord.
What does a dark lord mean?
I don't even know. but, you know, I don't think I'm so evil.
I want to get back to the testing because obviously you didn't just test the 1,000 recipes here, but you tested other recipes that you decided not to use.
Yeah.
So how many did you do altogether? Do you know?
Well, so about 1,400. Yeah.
1,400.
That's a lot. I mean,
and who ate all that food?
Well, me and my family, my kids. Actually, I had twins about midway through the research, and so they were really raised on all the food in the book. I mean, we just pureed these like 19th century dishes and
including pigeons and sea urchins.
Yes.
Well, I hope they come out of this really liking a wider range of foods than most kids.
Well, they either will or they'll just want junk food.
Uh-huh. I mentioned Julie and Julia earlier because there is a similarity here. You made a cameo appearance in that film.
Yeah.
So did you consider going into acting?
No, absolutely not. But I did actually have to audition for my part. Which was one of the most nervous.
You were Amanda Hesser in the
yes,
movie.
Yes, I know, but I had to.
Wasn't that typecasting?
You know, I just thought if I don't get this, that's going to just be a scar on my life forever. I'm going to have to feel, live with the fact that I couldn't even, get the part to play myself.
Now, one of the other things that we see in this book, and you see in the New York Times regularly, is a wide range of ethnic foods. Was that always the case? Because America's always been the melting pot.
You mean always been the case in the New York Times?
When you looked at the old – into the archives.
Yeah, there was
actually – in the 19th century, were they already giving us Chinese and Italian and Eastern European food?
There wasn't so much, I would say, Chinese, but there were, curries, and there was a fair amount of Indian, and certainly, yes, some Eastern European. There was quite a surprising variety of ethnic foods.
You have two challah recipes here,
yeah,
both rather untraditional. Well, they call for butter, and one calls for vanilla and cinnamon.
Yeah, it's a great recipe. You could always cut those flavoring details out if you'd like. But the one makes this giant loaf. I mean, it reminds me of the sort of bread coming out of the oven on I Love Lucy. Did you ever see that episode? She gets pinned against the wall from her loaf of bread, and it's a little bit like that. But it's the most delicious challah I've ever had.
She was actually a rather successful cook. She made a lot when she just was supposed to make a little bit of rice. It wound up being a huge amount. And she did the same with the bread. We should all figure out how she did that. She must have used balloons. How do you envision people using this book? Should it be considered more of an archive, or do you see it as an everyday tool?
No, absolutely not. I wanted this to be an everyday tool. I wanted this to be the book I wish I had had when I was first learning to cook, the one that sort of had every kind of important recipe from every era and great versions of them. You know, the thing is that, like, there are, great recipes from pretty much every sort of major chef from every period, and restaurant. And some of the, best food writers, Maida Heater, Marcella Hazan, their work has passed through the times, almost everyone's has. And so it all gets kind of distilled and collected here. And, and then there's, tons of Mark Bittman and Craig Claiborne and Pierre Franey and Molly O'Neill. And those are really the kind of, your everyday weeknight recipes.
Now, why do you think the plum tart has been so popular? We even got a comment from Ellen from Park Slope who says that it works well as a gluten-free recipe.
Oh, interesting. I'd be curious to know how that is done. That, I mean, it's a very simple recipe. I think that its popularity is due to a couple of factors. One is that it's about, I think, four or five ingredients, most of which, except for the plums, you probably already have in your home. The instructions are to just mix the ingredients together, all of them, except for the plums. You just literally stir them together. You don't have to cream the butter. You don't have to do anything in a specific order. You don't have to sift the flour. So if you can stir, you can make this cake. And then once you make it and you set the plums in the top, they sort of sink into the top of the cake like inlaid jewels. So it looks very beautiful. It looks a little exotic. It travels well. It freezes well. It has all the kind of like practical touches that home cooks want. Yet, it's really pleasing, and it's a little bit different from something you see every day.
The Times caused quite a stir a few years ago when they published Jim Leahy's No Knead Bread recipe.
Oh yeah, that's a great one.
And I know an awful lot of people who make that bread. It's fabulous, but it probably would not have been as well known if it hadn't been in the Times.
Well, I don't know. That's an interesting thought. I don't know yet, but there is something about that. You know, the word traveled really fast. It was one of like the sort of first what I think of as like viral recipes, and it fits. You know, the big barrier with making bread is kneading. So,
which just speeds up the operation, but if you just let it sit for a long time.
Yes.
The yeast will do the job for you.
Yeah, and nobody knew that. And everyone who was afraid of kneading suddenly had an opportunity to make bread, and it made this beautiful loaf. So, you know, again, it was sort of this, you know, paring something down, tweaking it so that it was no longer daunting. And there you go. That's sort of the magic for trick, or that's the formula for a popular recipe.
Hasn't working on this cookbook inspired another project for you? Can you tell us about Food 52?
Yeah, I'd love to. So my friend Meryl and I, who tested all the recipes for the Times cookbook, you know, one of the things we noticed was that some of the most popular recipes among Times readers tended to be recipes that appeared in the Times but actually came from home cooks, friends of Craig Claiborne's, etc. And so it just occurred to us that there was something about home cook recipes, like we were just discussing, that makes them memorable and special, and that and keeps them around for decades. And we'd also just been seeing like this huge explosion of food blogs. I mean, there were home cooks everywhere who wanted to express themselves and have a platform. And so we decided to create Food 52, a food community where we crowdsource recipes, we do contests, and and we curate, you know, as sort of experienced food editors and recipe testers, the recipes, and then the community does as well. They vote on the best recipes, and then the winning recipes go into a cookbook, which will be out in October.
So that'll be the next cookbook.
Yeah.
There have been a number of significant departures at the Times Sunday Magazine since the new editor, Hugo Lindgren, took over recently. Will you still be writing a food column there?
No, I'm not going to write a column.
You're going to be doing an op-ed column like Mark Bittman?
No, I'm not. But no, Hugo asked me to do like these sort of special features, like, you know, a handful of times a year. But I actually can't do it because Food 52 just takes up so much of my time, and we really want to focus on it. So I'm not going to be in the magazine for a while.
Amanda Hesser is the Essential New York Times Cookbook. Classic Recipes for a New Century is published by W.W. Norton and Company. It's been a lot of fun talking with you again.
Oh, it's been great to see you.